Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am John Milford, chair of the club's grown-ups forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to listen to us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel. First of all, District Attorney George Gascon. George Gascon is the district attorney for the city and county of San Francisco. He's earned a national reputation as a criminal justice visionary and as a leader who uses evidence-based practices to make communities safer by lowering crime. He's the first Latino to hold the office in San Francisco and is the nation's first police chief to become district attorney. District Attorney Gascon has 30 years' experience in law enforcement, promoting through the ranks to become assistant chief at the Los Angeles Police Department, chief of police in Mesa, Arizona, and chief of police in San Francisco. In addition to his criminal justice work at local, state, and national levels, District Attorney Gascon has worked on public safety initiatives in Latin America and in the Middle East. He's a board member of the Council of State Governments Justice Center and is a graduate of the FBI's National Executive Institute. He's a member of the Harvard University Kennedy School of Government's Executive Session on Policing and Public Safety. D.A. Gascon has secured convictions in over 95% of all elder abuse cases in 2007-2008. He made white-collar economic crimes unit responsible for financial crimes against seniors, and the Family Violence Unit handle all physical elder abuse cases to make handling of elder abuse cases more efficient. His office recently became the first jurisdiction in the country to successfully convict two blessing scam cases, a scam targeting Chinese women, mostly seniors. Our second panelist is Hubert H. Skip Humphrey, who joined the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau as the assistant director of its newly established Office for Older Americans in October 2011. He received his JD from the University of Minnesota in 1969, has practiced privately, served as a Minnesota state senator, and as the state's attorney general. As Minnesota's attorney general, he focused on consumer protection policy and enforcement. He initiated the first antitrust lawsuit against the tobacco industry, resulting in the disclosure of millions of pages of documents exposing the fraud and deception of the industry. He has taught at Harvard's Kennedy School, Institute of Politics, and at the University of Minnesota's School of Public Health. Skip has also served in the private sector as an executive at Tunheim Partners, a communication and public policy management company in Minneapolis. He is an avid biker and downhill skier. He and his wife, Lee, live in Golden Valley, Minnesota, where they enjoy being close to family and therefore grandchildren. And now I'll introduce our moderator, Helen Carr, Esquire. Helen Carr is a leader in the education and prevention of elder abuse with a focus on financial exploitation. She's worked at the state level as a member of the California Commission on Aging and the California Senior Legislature, where her proposals have become California law. First, banks and financial institutions are now mandated reporters of financial elder abuse. Secondly, the month of May every year is Elder and Dependent Adult Abuse Awareness Month. And thirdly, the State of California Joint Resolution requested that the President and Congress issue an Elder Abuse Aware semi-postage stamp. She was honored as a California State Legislature 2007 Woman of the Year. Ms. Carr has served as an elder abuse specialist for San Francisco District Attorney's Office, where she continues to work on the prevention of elder financial abuse, annuity, and other fraud. She's a research consultant for the State Bar of California's Seniors and the Law publication, and what you should know about elder abuse. I might also say that at age 64, Helen Carr went to law school and received her law degree so that she could work in this field to protect seniors from elder abuse. And I will now turn this over to our moderator, Helen Carr. Helen?
Thank you, John. Good evening, everyone. Welcome. Thank you for coming. And our thanks to the Commonwealth Club for providing this forum to explore elder financial abuse. And a special thanks to Dr. Gloria Duffy, the CEO and President of the Commonwealth Club, for her insight article that raised awareness on elder financial abuse. You can read it in the January 2013 Commonwealth Magazine, entitled Protecting Our Seniors. This is the second Commonwealth Club discussion around elder abuse prevention and elder financial abuse. And we will hear from two leaders in their respective field about elder abuse and what we can do to prevent it. My first question is to District Attorney Gascon. What is elder abuse, and why is elder abuse referred to as the silent crime?
You know, before I answer that question, I want to take a moment to commend Helen. For those of you that do not know Helen, and you heard a little bit about the introduction, but Helen is really an incredible woman and someone that we're very proud to have in our office. She did go to law school in her 60s, and her commitment was to make a difference for seniors in the state and this country. And she has been incredible in moving legislation forward, not only at the state level, but at the national level. And I just can't say enough about how proud I am of you being part of our office. Thank you for all you do, Helen. You know, elder financial abuse is a problem that is increasing. As our population is getting older, we are seeing an explosion of elder financial abuse. Here in San Francisco, as of 2010, 14% of our population is 65 or older. And we are sort of in a unique place because a large majority of our seniors are actually living independently. So that makes them even more susceptible to a lot of the scams. So we're seeing increasingly a lot of our seniors being targeted for a variety of scams, financial scams, and certainly a lot of physical abuse as well. And one of the problems with elder abuse that is somewhat unique, maybe with the exception if we're talking about abuse against very young people, is that the abusers often come from places of trust. It is often a family member. It is, quite frankly, many times as children, which makes it extremely difficult for the victim to actually come forward and report the crime. And many times the victim doesn't even know that they're being victimized. So it's not only is it a growing problem, but the complexity of the problem is increasing as well, because we are not only are we getting older in terms of our population, but we're also living longer. So the scope of the problem is continuing to increase, and frankly, in many areas, we're getting to places that we have never been. You know, often people are living way beyond what they plan for financially. Mm-hmm. And I can speak from personal opinion with my own parents, one being 92. So longevity, as well as the fact that, you know, we're just aging proportionally longer, you know, a greater numbers, is really creating a challenge for all of us. And I believe that we as a community have to work together to ensure that our elders are being protected. And there's a role for everyone. There's certainly a role for the prosecution, but there's a role for many others in the community to come together. So I'm really pleased that we're here today, and I'm looking forward to the dialogue. Skip.
Thank you. Yep.
Thank you. And now I would like to hear from Mr. Skip Humphrey. Tell us about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the Office for Older Americans.
Well, thank you very much, Helen. And I, too, want to share with you, first of all, congratulations. Taking on going to law school at 64, it was a challenge enough just doing it in the 20, when I was 20. But I congratulate you, and you do it for the right reason, to make a difference. And so I want to personally congratulate you on that. And, of course, Mr. District Attorney, your work, your discipline, your understanding of not only trying to prevent the crime, but also to make sure that those who commit these crimes understand there are consequences, are something that we all need to understand. There's two sides to this. How do we stop it? How do we prevent it from happening in the first place? But there's also that other side, which is if you commit the crime, guess what? There is going to be a consequence, and as it properly should be. So I want to thank you. The other thing that I would just like to say right off the bat is I'm a big fan of the Commonwealth Club. I listen on Minnesota Public Radio, and I love the forums that take place. It's a place where, after all of the politics and all of the partisanship, you can actually sit back and learn something. And so I am excited, and I am honored to be invited to be here. Now, having said that, I need to really caution myself. There are some genes that run through me that have a tendency to kind of go on and on and on. And we can't allow that to happen. These Humphrey genes kind of get loose sometimes. Let me just say also that to be here in this wonderful city, in this great state, is something very special, to be able to be honored here tonight and this evening. And also, it's the Elder Abuse Awareness Month in California. I think that's great that the state recognizes this as a serious problem, as does the nation. May is the Older American Month nationally that is being honored and made aware of. Folks are being made aware of. I want to tell you a little bit about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the Office of Financial Protection for Older Americans, if I can. I'll try and keep it as brief as possible, but I want you to understand how I hope it will complement the good work that the district attorney is doing and others in this state are doing, because we really need to work strongly in partnership to make this a successful effort. The mission of the Bureau, the Consumer Bureau, I think is important for all Americans, and it's to ensure that markets for consumer financial products and services are fair, that they're transparent, that they are competitive so that we have a free choice for good products at good prices, and that everyone has access to those markets. And as the markets become more complex and more challenging for each of us, we need to make sure that everyone is still included in this great nation, in our economy, in the financial marketplace. The way we do that at the Bureau is to make the rules more effective, to be consistent and fair in the enforcement of those rules, and to empower consumers to take more control over their economic lives. The district attorney did a great job of explaining that we're living longer. So having that level and that ability to live independently longer is very, very important. And that's an important challenge and charge for part of the mission of the Bureau. With regard to the Office of Older Americans, there are two basic areas that we are looking at in terms of our mission. And the first is to help older Americans make sound financial decisions as we age. This is an area in which we want to complement the good work that is being done all around the country in this effort of trying to provide that information. The second part is, frankly, to stop the scams and to support efforts that Mr. Gascon and others are doing in making sure that we bring people to term with the consequences that they deserve for making these kinds of crime occur. And so that's very important. Let me just give you a couple of things that I hope you would keep. I know all of you are just as sharp as a tack, just like me, on the Internet. But if you haven't gone on the Internet too much, go here. Go to Consumer Finance, all one word, consumerfinance.gov. That is the Bureau's website, and you will find lots of very interesting information. Our Office of Consumer Response accepts consumer complaints, and you can see that, and you can actually file a complaint if you have one right directly from that website. And I can tell you that we've been working on any number of areas, and we're expanding those areas of a review as we go. Now, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is barely 2 years old. So it's kind of a new agency in the federal government. But I think we've taken a very positive kind of effort in trying to help consumers. There are other agencies in the federal government that have some responsibilities and do respond in some ways to consumers. But the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has a unique perspective of looking at all of the responsibilities that the Bureau has, which includes supervising banks, large banks, and others, from the consumer's point of view. And that's a terribly important part to remember, I think. Now, with regard to the Office of Older Americans, there are a number of special populations offices, one of which is the Office of Older Americans. There is also students, an office for students, office for military service members and their families, an office of empowerment for those who do not have all the resources and don't always use the traditional financial institutions. And we, of course, also have a very large office that helps us with education and engagement and financial literacy issues. Now, the two areas that we're looking at, as I said, is to help individuals make those sound decisions, and then to really stop, to identify and avoid the unfair, deceptive, and abusive and discriminatory practices that take too much. Let me step back for 1 second. I'm sorry if I'm going a little too fast, but we need to frame this as how it faces the country as a whole. Do you realize that it has been estimated that older Americans either own, possess, or have management control over some $17 trillion worth of assets? So when someone says, well, why do those guys always target seniors? Well, it's a little bit like, you know, the guy who was robbing the banks when they asked him on the witness stand, why do you rob banks, Mr. Sutton? He said, well, that's where the money is. Well, that's where the money is in a whole lot of part of our very large economy. It's in the hands of seniors. And so we have a really serious problem. This is an epidemic that is truly under the radar. It's underreported, as the district attorney described. People are concerned. They are embarrassed personally that maybe it's happening to them. All too often it's happening because of family members or close friends or relatives, and they don't want to make those kinds of reports. Although I must say, I think it's people are becoming more aware that they do have to speak up and speak out. And that's really important. So we're looking at those kinds of things. You know the scams that are going on out there. You get those calls in the night. You get the letters in the mail that tell you that you are the one that has won the lottery. No one else in the country, just you. And all you need to do is send that money. You know, don't do it. Do not do it. That's the most important thing. So I won't go through all of that. But let me just mention that there's another problem here. As we age, that muscle between our ears, the brain, you know, there is some level of diminished capacity. And unfortunately, some of the things that go first are the ability to deal with complex financial decisions. When I was growing up, and I'm sure the audience here, when you were growing up, financing was, did you balance the checkbook? Did you put the check in the bank? And did you pay your single credit card? Now think about all of the products and services and this ever-expanding financial marketplace that we have and the complexity of it. It is very, very challenging for older Americans. And so we need to look at that. So we know that there are declining skills that can be detected in people with mild cognitive impairment. How do we help people stay independent during that aging process as long as they possibly can? And then there's the dual problem. Adults with diminished capacity need decision makers to handle their affairs, but those same very decision makers all too often become the ones that are abusing, that are taking the money, that are stealing and creating the theft and elder exploitation. So we have those kinds of concerns that we have to deal with it. Let me tell you a little bit of just some of the things that the Office of Financial Protection for Older Americans is doing. First of all, to help people who are helping seniors. These are people who are under powers of attorney, or they may be guardians or conservators, or they may just be informal caregivers. We are going to produce later this summer lay fiduciary guides. You are put in a position, you do the work because you care and love about the individual, but you are put in a position where you need to know what the accounting requirements are, what the fiduciary responsibilities are, and we want to give that kind of lay advice to these individuals so that they can do the right thing at the right time. And that's number one. We're going to do that. Number two, many individuals are in cognitive care facilities, and those managers, all too often, when they first recognize that some problem is existing, it's when the person isn't paying the bill to stay. And all too often, they have to force them out. We want to help them with lay fiduciary guides for cognitive facilities managers and to see that they not only can anticipate what may be some financial problems, but also to see the red flags that cause the that may be the indicators of elder financial abuse and exploitation by others. There are also some other things that we're doing, and I just want to skip over very quickly on that. There's a program called Money Smart that the FDIC has had. We're going to expand that, and we're joining together with our colleague federal agency, and we're going to have efforts to help out people with modules that relate to senior financial protection efforts, and that's one of the areas that we're working on. Jennifer Duane with my office is here tonight. She is a great Californian. We're taking her experience in the elder prevention networks that she has established in this state, and we're amplifying that across the nation, and we're working with other organizations throughout the country to develop dynamic partnerships between the CFPB and our office, the Older Americans office, and those organizations. Now, let me give you just two other areas that we want to take a look at, and you may have seen. I'm sure you have all seen those ads in the on the television that you really ought to have a reverse mortgage. Well, let me caution you. The reverse mortgage may be an appropriate product or service that you might need at some point. But be sure you understand that there are plenty of alternatives and know all of the circumstances surrounding the use of these products. I am sorry, but I don't think you get the full understanding in a 30-second commercial from some folks that were doing other things in their lives. I think you need good counseling, and with if you are interested in a reverse mortgage, there are ways of getting that very good counseling. It's required if you're going to have a federally insured reverse mortgage, and ask somebody good, tough questions. One other area that we're working in, there are several other areas, but one other particular area that we're working in is the situation in which individuals, you know, seniors have worked hard all their lives, and they have accumulated resources, principally their home and other financial products. You may have a 401k, or you may have a pension if you still have that, and you probably have IRAs and those kinds of things. Well, where are you getting your advice? From whom are you getting your best advice? The financial advisors. We're looking to help you understand better what all those little alphabet letters after your financial advisor's name is all about. And we have issued a report, as Congress asked us to, for recommendations to Congress and to the SEC. And also, we have included states because states also have very important and significant regulatory areas to take up in this area. And so that you can have better clarification of just exactly who those people are, what kind of background they've had, whether or not they are conforming with the standards of the certifying agency, whether they're accredited. Those are the kind of things that we think would help people make wise and sound decisions as they seek their financial advisor's advice and understanding. I will leave it at that. There are any number of other things that we can talk about, but I have a sense that this Humphrey's been running on a little too long here.
Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. No, we enjoyed everything you talked to us about, and we'll go back to some of those areas. Okay, thank you. D.A. Gascon, can you give us some examples of elder financial abuse that you see in the office?
Yeah, absolutely. We see a variety of cases, and later on I'll go into some actual cases, but often we're seeing telemarketing scams. We're seeing mortgage fraud. We see people being asked and signing, or someone signing for them powers of attorney, so that then they turn around and they start opening bank accounts or getting telephone accounts under your name, or, you know, just basically moving assets without the knowledge of the victim. Obviously, the fake charities have been around forever. They continue to be. You know, we're seeing here in San Francisco, but actually throughout the nation with the elderly Chinese female population, we're seeing this explosion of blessing scams. Just in the last year that we know of, probably a little over $1 million have been scammed from elderly Chinese women, most of them who, quite frankly, can't afford to get the money they were given, their life savings. We see, you know, the counterfeiting of debit cards, checks, theft of credit cards, and as I mentioned earlier, a significant number of these crimes are being committed by people that are very close to the victims. So, in fact, we estimate approximately over 50%, probably around 55% of all these crimes are being committed by someone that the victim has entrusted and has a great deal of trust. Theft of mail is another one. One of the things that, you know, a lot of folks, especially elderly folks, is still under the old days that you had that mailbox that anybody can go in and just open up that thing and pull it off. And if you have one of those, please replace it. That is one of the easiest way for people to steal your identity and open bank accounts and do all kinds of things with your identity. You know, that as Skip mentioned, you just won the lottery or you won the whatever sweepstakes, you know, the publisher's house or whatever else is out there. I always think of the publisher's house because I think my mother has more subscriptions than any human being can have. And she doesn't read half of them. So, you know, so all those magazine scams, obviously on a lower level, but nevertheless, you know, they take money from you or you get the firefighters fund or the police officers ball and all that stuff. You know, most of those things are all, they're really ripping people off, and we need to stop it. And the way to do it is through prevention. You know, in the office, we have taken a very aggressive stance on preventing these crimes. We do a lot of public education. We spend a lot of time going to senior centers. We actually put ads in our Muni buses. We have a hotline. But it really requires, again, I mentioned this earlier, but I'm going to continue to say this throughout the night. It really requires the community to come together. If you have a neighbor, if you have a relative, and if you see that there is something there that may not make a little sense, you know, ask the questions. Call for help. You know, often we have seen some horrendous things happening right next door to people that are good, caring people that were noticing that something maybe was quite not there. But nobody was, you know, they were hesitant to pick up the phone and make the call. And I think that we really have to take that village concept that we're all together in this and that the only way that we can prevail in many of these cases is by having the entire community coming together.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. And now I would like to ask Mr. Humphrey, just explain a little bit more about your fiduciary guide. I think that's exciting.
Well, as I said, it's a lay fiduciary guide. It is not a legal document, but it will kind of identify what is required of the caregiver. And, the interesting thing about this is we understand that now in order for elders to live that independent life, they are going to have to work more closely and depend upon the next generation. And that's a challenge itself. That generation has kids and other things going on at the same time. So we need to have the way in which that individual who is the caregiver understand the responsibilities that they're taking on. And then to go seek either the professional advice or support from other organizations and efforts that will guide them in the right direction. Also to understand what's wrong. What you shouldn't do. You know, how many times have you heard the story? Well, I take mom to the doctor. I take her to the dentist. The car is falling apart. She's told me that she's going to leave me enough money so that I can get it. You know, I can take her. Why don't I just buy a new car and I'll continue to take her? No, you don't do that. That is not your money. It is, that's a life's earnings that is owned by and should be controlled on behalf of the elder. And so that's the most innocent situation. Then you have the ones that are more purposeful, who literally are stealing the money. And they may be, I think the more reality kind of situation is where they may be having to support a alcohol or a drug addiction. And so they think, well, mom or dad's money is there and I'm supposed to be the one taking care of this. I think I'll just take a little. And that's something that's really unfortunate. So hopefully these lay guides will help people understand what is right and what their responsibilities are. And the other part of that, of course, is to make sure that we're working with chief justices of the states and their court administrators to make sure that we have the kind of standards in place when court-appointed administrator or court-appointed guardians or conservators are in place are doing the right thing as well.
Thank you very much. D.A. Gascon, can you tell us about some of the cases you're handling in the office presently, and what are some of the challenges of prosecuting elder abuse?
Well, for instance, we were talking about mortgage fraud, and we had a case last year that we wound up with 31 different victims. But one of the victims that really was so concerning to us was an elderly Spanish-speaking woman. In this particular case, the defendants that were all convicted, but they were real estate agents, they were mortgage brokers, and one of them was a preacher as well. So he was holding multiple titles, and as a minister, he had a certain standing within the community. People really believed this person. And what they were doing is they were switching the role from the minister to the real estate broker/mortgage broker. And in some cases, they falsified documents. They obtained title to property. They negotiated property. They obtained first and second trust deeds and homes. We have one particular lady, 71-year-old woman. Really, her asset was her home, which was almost paid for. And what they did is they transferred title, fraudulently transferred title to this home. They then proceeded to mortgage the home to the point of no return. When the home went into foreclosure, then is when the victim actually realized that the document that she had signed for a small second trust deed loan actually had been used to mortgage a home much more deeply than it had originally been planned. And her home was in foreclosure, and she actually lost her home. And it was really heartbreaking for us as we were trying to unravel this case. And as I indicated, there were about 31 victims, so there were about 30 others that lost money at different stages. But this was a total of about $2.2 million that were taken from victims that, quite frankly, none of them could afford this. This were not affluent people. These were people that truly their entire life savings were there, and there was very little recovery because most of the money had been obviously spent by the time that we were able to freeze assets. And we're still actually trying to work restitution in this case, but it's very, very difficult because, the assets are mostly gone. I mentioned earlier also the blessing scams, and the blessing scams are occurring nationwide. We're actually probably the first place that noticed this occurring, and we have been very aggressive. In fact, we just we got two convictions just in the last 10 days. We prosecuted three cases. But these cases are, again, cases that are very disturbing. And basically the way these cases are occurring is you have generally a team of three. They're usually the offenders are women. They're mostly Cantonese speakers. They're actually traveling, and it's a scam that is going on worldwide. They started doing this years ago in Hong Kong, but we actually track some traveling activities. Some of our offenders, we have seen them being in Singapore, stopping in New Zealand and other places. So they're actually going around, and they will go into a like the United States when they come here – What they would do is basically they work on the theme of three, and they're really preying on the sort of the superstitions of elderly Chinese women. The way the scam works in, is sort of along those lines. The first person will approach the victim, generally in a public place. It could be a bus stop. It could be a shopping center. And they engage in a conversation, and very quickly they start talking about they perceive that there is some level, something, there's some negativity around this person. And they start asking about their family, so they very quickly determine if they're kids or grandkids. And then the next thing that they talk about is, you know, you really need to have a blessing ritual because I see some death around the family or some bad things happening. And then during this conversation, then usually there's a second person that sort of casually just bumps into this and joins in very casually as they just overheard the conversation, say, you know, I know someone that can help you. You know, I know someone that can actually do a blessing ritual. And long and behold, shortly thereafter, there appears a third person that promises they can do this. And then they tell the victim, you know, go home. Bring money, bring jewelry, bring it in a bag, and we will do a blessing ritual, and then everything will be okay. So the victims go, and they will bring, they'll take their savings, and we have seen literally people taking their life savings, taking, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $10,000. We had a lady that worked behind a kitchen, it saved most of her life to save $10,000, and she brought it in. And then what they do is they conduct a ritual, and then during the process there's a switch, pretty much like the old Jamaican switch type stuff. And then the victim is told, you know, take it home, put it under your bed, or put it in a safe place, wait a few days or a couple of weeks, and then when you open it up, everything, you know, your family will be okay. Of course, when the victim opens the bag, there is no longer any valuables there, and by that time the offenders are long gone. Unfortunately, what occurs here is the victims feel they're ashamed of themselves. They don't want to tell their kids. I know for a fact because I've talked through a translator, and most of those women are either monolingual, Cantonese speakers, or very limited English speakers. So I talked to someone through a translator, and they were very openly telling me how, you know, they didn't want to tell their family because, you know, there would be ridicule. They didn't want to tell anybody else. So they really suffer in silence. And it wasn't until we became very aggressively in our information campaign and actually went into the centers where a lot of these folks would congregate that we started actually seeing an increased number of people reporting this crime. And we were fortunate enough. One case, an arrest was made at SFOS. People were getting ready to go back to mainland China. Another arrest was made at LAX when somebody was getting ready to go to China. And then we had the real success case that we had is where there were two victims. Victim number two, actually, she was approached, and she went through the scam, and she was going to go home and get some money. And on the way home, sort of a light went on and says, I just remember somebody talking about this. And she decided to go to the police. And then the police came back because she had an agreement to meet these people back. And this was at the Alemany Farmers Market. They went back. And as they went back, actually, they observed victim number one actually giving her money to the suspects, a total of $47,000. And the suspects were getting ready. They were running into a taxi. The officers were able to make the arrest. And we just finished prosecuting these cases and got guilty verdicts in all three for theft and attempt theft. But here's the one thing that I'd like to talk about because I think is, you know, even more important than the description of the case. There seems to be a general skepticism, you know, and I have faced this even with the media and other community members that say, well, they're stupid, you know, why would you do that, you know? And I've even, you know, just sort of off the record talking to a reporter, have to walk them through and educate people. Let me put it to you another way, and I hope that I'm not offending anyone here because I really don't intend to do so, but I think it's important to just lay it out in a way that culturally makes sense to many of us. You know, many people in our community would give all kinds of money to a tele-evangelist, right? Many people in our community will give money to other scams. So these women are not necessarily stupid. They're just being taken advantage of based on a vulnerability that they have. But by the way, guess what? We are all vulnerable in our own very way, our own different ways. We have our own cultural vulnerabilities, and we have ways that people can get to us. So one of the things that I spend a great deal of time, because it's really rough for us with our juries, you know, educating a jury that, you know what, this is a real crime, this is a real victim, and no, she did not have it coming to her. Somebody just exploited a vulnerability much the same way that someone in more of our mainstream society may sign a power of attorney to a relative, and then they turn around and take your savings away, or some of the other scams that we have going around the community. So part of what we try to do is educate, not only dealing with the communities that are being impacted, but educating the communities at large, that we're all in this together. Just because this particular scam happens to take a context that is culturally based in one community, guess what?
Yeah.
Other communities are being impacted just as well, and we need to understand that, and we need to be sensitive to that, and we need to work together to stop this. The scams that I'm telling you, by the way, they're happening in New York, they're happening in Chicago, L.A. As a matter of fact, the Manhattan DA now is looking at a couple of, well, actually three of our suspects. They're probably going to extradite him, but they're asking us, how do I go about prosecuting this case? Because I'll tell you another interesting thing that happened in the middle of this case. As we proceeded with discovery in the case and we're moving forward with our first case, it became clear to us that the defense was going to allege that the offenders were victims of human trafficking. And they were really doing this at the behest of a larger organization. And frankly, I'm very sensitive to human trafficking. In fact, in my office, we do a lot of work on this, and we believe that it's a major problem. But we really had no evidence to believe that this was a human trafficking case. So we had to go about it starting to develop a case to show that human trafficking was nowhere near. And this is how we became aware of the travelings of this group, how they were going to Singapore, they were going to Hong Kong. The fact that when some of them were arrested, they were freely traveling. They had their own passports. They were carrying significant amount of cash with them, things that would not be that normally would not be associated with a victim of human trafficking. If you're being trafficked, you know, it's very unlikely that you're going to be allowed to hold on to your passport. It's very unlikely you're going to be allowed to move around freely. It's very unlikely you're going to be allowed to hold large sums of cash. But we actually had to go through all of this because the defense, and we actually, you know, we had a community-based organization here in the city that fully went all out to try to make this into a human trafficking case. So not only did we have to deal with a traditional prosecution in this, but we were sort of being put in a corner as we were being somehow insensitive to the whole crime of human trafficking. And frankly, I mean, at one point they were trying to corner me because they knew that that is a sensitive part for me, because I have worked very aggressively going after human trafficking. And they were saying, well, how can you prosecute? This woman's a really victim of human trafficking. And we had to spend a great deal of time to deal with this. So when Manhattan calls, they're kind of facing a similar situation, so we had to sort of walk them through. So even sometimes well-intended people can come in the middle of a prosecution and really try to reach a result that would be totally horrible if they have been successful. So that's really a couple of cases. I know we're going to have some other things, so I don't want to monopolize the conversation here.
Well, thank you. We all learned a little more about the Chinese blessing scam. That is, thank you very much, D.A. Gascon. Thank you. Now, some last remarks for Mr. Humphrey.
Well, I just want to compliment the district attorney in this effort. Understand what's going on here. You have individuals who are isolated, one-on-one with professionals. These are well-trained, well-understood con artists. They know exactly what they're doing, and they know how to play on your emotions. They know how to isolate you. They know how to they know where the resources are. They're not just accidentally coming up to you. They've already done all their research. And this is the same thing that happens when you get a night call at 2 a.m. in the morning about a nephew or a grandson or somebody that has been in trouble across the border and you need to send money right away. Well, first of all, think about it. If you get a phone call at 2 o'clock in the morning, how sharp are you? They know exactly what they're doing. And so I would just say this, that we as citizens must understand that if it sounds too good to be true, if it sounds too unusual, step back. Step back. Take a moment. Ask a friend. Ask another relative. What's going on? And catch yourself before you send that money away or give that money away. Because these folks, they're pros. They know exactly what's going on. And when it's in the family, the same thing operates. Make sure that you're asking the larger number of family members, is this right? Is this what I should be doing? You know, we need to help each other. This is a community-wide concern, both in a closer community of a family as well as a larger community of a city and of a county and of a state and of a nation. It's huge. There are significant amounts of money going out, and we need to put a stop to it. And the only ones that could do it are us.
Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. And right. D.A. Gascon, any more remarks before I ask you, where can seniors turn for help?
Well, absolutely. Certainly, one of the places that they can come is to our office. You know, we have a team that is completely dedicated to working on elder abuse, and we actually have, we have two teams, because we have a team that deals with financial elder abuse, which is sometimes connected to physical elder abuse, but their expertise are somewhat different. They're not necessarily in silos. They work together, but we have people that work in both. We also have, you know, we work with community-based organizations, certainly self-help for the elderly, the Institute of Aging, Adult Protective Services. San Francisco, actually, we're very fortunate. We're really very service-rich. This is a great community when it comes to services, but you have to make the call. And if you see someone is having problems, or if you yourself believe that you're being possibly victimized, you know, don't hesitate to call. We often will work with people that are not necessarily ready to prosecute, meaning they're not necessarily ready to cooperate with the prosecution. And we work with those. You know, we have a victim services unit. Last year we serviced approximately 5,500 victims. Many of those people were not necessarily someone that was ready to cooperate in the prosecution. So there's a lot of things that we can do for you at our office, and we can certainly connect you with other services as well. But somebody has to make the call, you know, so you have to reach out. You either, if you need help, you need to call us, or if you know someone else that needs help. By the way, we take anonymous calls as well. You know, if you're not sure that you want to get personally involved, but you think that your next-door neighbor, you know, there is something going on that, you know, the kids are all of a sudden have this unexplained wealth, that you know that these kids are not working for it. You know, also going to drive me that new car that is way too expensive for the kind of work that they do. You know, give us a call. We can send an investigator. We can have a very low-key conversation. We can do a lot of things very quickly to assess whether there is a problem or not. But the call has to be made first.
Thank you. And then we will have questions, time for questions after. Mr. Humphrey, one last comment on where seniors can go for help. We know they can go to your website.
I said earlier, and I just want to reiterate, number one, if you have some thoughts, take a look at consumerfinance.gov. That is our website. And frankly, participate in that. There are a couple of things you can do. There's an area there where you can tell your story. Sometimes just telling the story helps others that are reading that and say, oh, yeah, that's what was happening to me. Or I know someone that happened to, and it begins that dialogue that we need to have nationally. There's also Ask CFPB there. So you can ask a question, and we'll get an answer back. But then we learn from the questions that you ask for what other kinds of answers should be given. So it's a kind of an iterative thing that we go back and forth with. And then I want to suggest that certainly give a call to the district attorney's office if you have a serious question about something that you see happening. Give a call to the attorney general's office in this state. Very active organizations like that will take up the effort to help you. And then there are any number of other organizations that you can visit with. What you don't want to do is stay alone and stay quiet. We need to have people report these concerns and these crimes. And the more that we do that, the easier it will be to put an end to it.
Thank you. And then after Mr. Milford, then we'll have question and answers.
We'd like to remind our listening audience this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to District Attorney George Gascon, Skip Humphrey from the Consumer Protection Bureau in Washington, and their program is The Silent Crime, Elder Financial Abuse. I know their questions. Before we start questions, we have a visitor from England from Adult Protective Services, and I'm wondering if there's anyone in the room from Adult Protective Services here in this country. Look around. See? All right. You might want to talk later. All right. Fine. Questions? Candice, will you? So you can be heard. We'll pass the microphone and take the questions.
Yeah, how can we assess whether our, quote, people who are children or relatives are doing right by us? In other words, how can we watch the watchers and say that they're not, you know, taking advantage of us financially?
Well, you know, that's one of the things. That's a very good question. How do we watch the watchers, so to speak? And that's one of the reasons that we are going to produce those lay fiduciary guides. They will also be up on our website, by the way, so that the public will know what the responsibilities are. And that's going to be, I think, very helpful. The other thing is, have a conversation. You know, talk about what is going on. In my own family, I got to tell you, I'm a young 70-year-old going on 71 pretty darn quick here. My wife and I are having conversations with our family members about what our resources are, what we hope we will have so that we don't burden the next generation, but what we also are going to need. And so having that conversation can help smooth out. Now, not every family can do that. Sometimes there's real disruption in families, and so it's not always that easy. But I would say those are two things that certainly we're going to be helpful with.
Yes, hello. I have a question for District Attorney Gascon. You mentioned, the two of you mentioned a couple reasons why this doesn't get reported. One is that people don't even know they've been victimized, perhaps for a long time, like the woman who probably didn't even know she'd been victimized until she was being evicted from her home. And another is that they're embarrassed to come forward because it's a family member, a person in trust. So these both tend to cause long delays from the time that a crime was committed until the time when any action, if ever, is taken to try to correct the problem. And that brings to mind the whole issue of statute of limitations, which is a big issue with an elderly woman who I personally know. She's not related to me, but she's been victimized by her brother with financial abuse that took place years ago. And now I'm kind of getting the sense in talking to some people that there's just nothing she can do about it, even though she couldn't really have done anything much sooner than she is anyway. How do you deal with that that conflict?
Yeah. First of all, if she's local, is she local?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to get her information before we leave. Generally, a statute of limitations on a fraud is going to run from the time that we realize that a fraud occurred, right? So even though the theft may have occurred a long time ago, if she recently couldn't have known that there was a theft, the statute will run from the time that she actually realizes, oops, you know, someone has taken my money and they did not have a right to do so. So I really like to get her information and let us take a look. because we have had a couple of opportunities to look at cases that people thought were too old. Now, the problem with those older cases, of course, is, you know, there may be the need for a lot of forensic accounting. I mean, it may be very difficult to piece all the evidence, right, especially if we're talking about decades ago, which in some cases it could be. But nevertheless, let's take a look at it first. Precisely, though, you underline very well the problem as we stated here. Often the victims do not know that they're being victimized, or they may know, but they're ashamed. You know, if you talk to Mr. Rooney, he would tell you, you know, he was being victimized by his own family, and he just did not know how to come around and say so. It is not unusual for you know, the children to be the ones that are doing this. And frankly, sometimes there are some, you know, they're doing it. They know that what they're doing is wrong, but they don't think it's that terribly wrong. It's almost like they have this sort of, they start sort of, you know, justifying this whole thing. Like Skip said, you know, my car is breaking down. You know, mom and dad have a bunch of money. I need a new car. Let's just buy a car, right? Well, it's wrong. That's not what you're supposed to do. But they sort of come to a way that they start rationalizing the effect of what they're doing. And sometimes the victims will actually start buying into that process as well. So public education is really the key here. And it's public awareness not only for the seniors but for all of us. But the case that you mentioned, I'd like to get that information before we leave tonight. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, well, I'm a very unusual case. I have a business in San Francisco, and I employ 17 people. And I came with $20 and an immigrant. And I have a daughter with three children and a son-in-law. And I pay them $120,000 a year. And they don't talk to me. Because last year they wanted to take the business away from me because $120,000 wasn't enough. And I wouldn't agree to that because they wanted literally throw me out. And so they punish me. They don't talk to me. My daughter didn't talk to me and my son-in-law didn't talk to me. Then they forbid me to visit. They have a house which I gave him the down payment. He did not allow me to visit my grandchildren. And then, so my daughter came to visit me with the children, and then he didn't like that either, so she wasn't allowed because every time she came, he had a fit after she got home. So anyhow, I am now in a position. They don't talk to me. I have a $1 million business. I came with $20 to this country. I have a business on Bush Street, and I have to talk to my daughter only talks to an employee which doesn't speak English. She has to email her, and then she asks me, how do you spell that word? My daughter doesn't talk to me. My son-in-law doesn't talk to me, and I haven't seen my grandchildren for a year and a half, and my husband neither. We are not allowed, you know. So how do you? And I had to see a psychiatrist because I got into depression last year, and I had to. I consulted three lawyers; they couldn't help me. I went counseling; they couldn't help me. So you are my last hope. You are my last hope. I don't know.
Well,
what to do. I don't know what to do.
Well, you have a very difficult case, right? Yeah. I mean, so far, I don't know that there is a crime that has been committed other than you mentioned domestic violence. Huh? Did you mention that I heard you say that one time when your son-in-law heard that your daughter was seeing you, he abused her, or did I misheard you? No? Okay, never mind.
No, domestic violence.
Okay, okay.
It's just money, you know?
Okay.
And he calls me up. Okay. Your daughter has anxiety attack. We need $3,000. And he doesn't go.
If I could just say, I think that the story you're telling is reflective of sometimes the difficult situation in families to try and deal with these kinds of relationships. Let me just give you one example. I was in Memphis visiting a little earlier last year with a group of seniors who were trying to help other seniors. And we were talking a little bit about, well, how do you make that decision as to who's supposed to be the person that's going to be the caregiver and make these decisions? And one woman, she raised her hand and she said, Mr. Humphrey, I know exactly what you're talking about. I've got 7 kids. I love every single one of them, but I only trust 3 of them. And, you know, what she was saying is it's kind of funny at one point, but it's another point of she's trying to make the difficult decision as to who should that person be that's going to provide that advice and have that responsibility and the authority to make important financial decisions. We have to remember, a person's life is on the line. Everything you've worked for your whole life, your pension, your home, all of the assets that are reflective in a financial way of your life is on the line. And you are now having to make a decision as to who is going to help you guide and use those resources for your interest. That's not easy, particularly when you have all of the emotions of a family that's tied into it. So it's something very important that we have to work through in our society even more so. And we have to be open. We cannot, as Mr. Coscone says, this is a community problem. We need to deal with it openly as a society. And this wonderful forum that we're having tonight is part of that.
And before we leave, I'd like to take, I'm not really sure what the solution is. I want to be very honest. But I don't want your money. I'd like to take your name and number. And we're going to see if we can get some help, and perhaps Helen, we can figure out someone that may be helpful.
I would appreciate it.
Okay.
Unfortunately, our time is gone, but I would ask if the distinguished panel would be willing to stay, maybe answer some questions individually.
Sure.
Would you
sure.
be willing to do that?
Yes.
All right.
Good.
All right. Our thanks to District Attorney Gascon and Skip Humphrey that were our speakers tonight. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 110th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.
Unbelievable.